grab your lightsabers and turn up the radio. We're going on a galaxy quest. The Republic has fallen. Sith Lords rule the galaxy. Jedi Master Obi-Wan Kenobi has lost everything. Everything but hope. Tatooine, in a harsh desert world where farmers toil in the heat of two suns while trying to protect themselves and their loved ones from the marauding Tusken Raiders. A backwater planet on the edge of civilized space, and an unlikely place to find a Jedi Master in hiding. Or an orphaned infant boy whose tiny shoulders rest the future of a galaxy. Hi, I'm Rick Ryer, filling in for Glenn Moberg this week, and I'm excited to welcome back author John Jackson Miller to our studios. John is from Iola, Wisconsin, but his name and work is well known throughout the Star Wars universe. His latest novel, Star Wars Kenobi, hits the galaxy next week. John, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Rick.
To join our conversation, call us at 800-780-9742 or drop a note on Facebook at Route 51 Show. John, what's a guy from central Wisconsin doing in a galaxy far, far away?
Having way too much fun and, doing as I've always said, I'm trying to strip mine my childhood for a living. It's been this way for a very long time now, and I'm glad I'm able to continue working in the worlds of comics and science fiction and all of that, the sort of things that I started doing when I was a kid.
Now, how did you get all involved with this whole Star Wars thing way back when?
Well, I saw the movie after I actually read the comics based on the movie. You could not get in to see the movie in 1977. This was the days before the multiplex theaters. We had only one cinema in our neighborhood that had the movie, and my sister kept taking me to try to get in to see it again and again, and we never could get in. I think one time we had to go see Pete's Dragon instead, and I have resented Helen Reddy ever since. But she finally got us in to see the movie, and in fact, Star Wars Kenobi is dedicated to my sister for her diligence in making sure that I got in. I really started to eat up all of the Star Wars comics and the Star Wars games, the novels that were being done. I continued to read them, and continued to be interested in the material after the Star Wars movies were seemingly done in 1983. There developed a number of licensees that continued to put out Star Wars material. Game companies, Dark Horse got the comics license again. Ballantine and then later Del Rey got the publishing license again, and more novels and things began coming out. And it was something that I obviously continued to involve myself in as a fan, but professionally it wasn't really until the early 2000s, mid 2000s. That I became connected with it. I was working as a journalist in the comics industry. I was editing the trade magazine for the comics business. I decided that I was more interested in writing the stories than writing about them, and did a year writing Iron Man at Marvel and started writing some Simpsons comics at Bongo Comics, which is the licensee for them. And then in 2004, I guess it was, I got the opportunity to write a single fill-in comic book story for one of the Star Wars titles. It was actually a detective story starring Darth Vader as the detective, which is actually cooler than it sounds. He doesn't have the Sherlock Holmes hat on and everything. But that was the entree to that world, because there then followed the opportunity to write my own Star Wars series called Knights of the Old Republic. It ran for about 5 years, and actually just yesterday they began releasing the omnibus collections, where you can get this entire series in three giant volumes. And of course, comics led to writing in prose, and that brings us to Kenobi.
Well, it's really interesting. I was there on opening night, though. I'm sorry to tell you that, but I was here in Wausau at the Grand Theater, a huge screen. And I remember it very well. But who'd have thought that Star Wars would have such staying power from back in 1977 to today, and it looks like in many years to come?
Well, Star Wars certainly changed how movies were made. Star Wars changed how movies were marketed. Star Wars changed how movies were financed. You know, George Lucas at the time got the, as part of his deal, he got the rights for all the ancillary merchandise. You know, the spin-off materials, the spin-off properties that, you know, the, and back at the time, nobody thought that was any big deal at all, because what would that mean? That would mean a t-shirt here or there. You know, Planet of the Apes had comic books. That was about it. But of course, it turned out to be this gargantuan thing where, you know, you can find Star Wars imprinted on everything from toothbrushes to, you know, action figures to anything you want to find. And, you know, one of the things that, that was out there that you know, continued to support the line was these stories, these novels, these comics. They were done by some of the best names in each of these individual fields. And the really cool thing that they came up with in the early 90s was this notion that what happens in the comics and what happens in the novels, what happens in the video games even, really happens to the characters. There's a single continuity, there's a single long storyline that everything fits into. And what that meant was that, unlike, you know, some of the novels based on TV shows and movies in the past, these tie-in stories, this material actually mattered. It was a way for you to keep reliving and continue to live in the world of Star Wars after the movies were off the screen.
Well, let's talk about the new book. Now, during the introduction of the show, I read from the inner flap of the book. But when I got to tell you this, when I first read it to myself, I immediately went back in my mind to the films between number 3 and number 4.
That's right.
That space in between there. And I thought, brilliant. You mean that's incredible. When did you start writing Kenobi?
I came up with the notion about 7 years ago. It was actually first conceived as a graphic novel project with my editor, Jeremy Barlow, at Dark Horse at the time. We were kicking around ideas for various things, and at some point we discussed, you know, our love of Westerns, and particularly the movie Shane, you know, the old Alan Ladd film from the 50s. And one of the things that just dawned on me is that it made perfect sense that, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi on Tatooine, this is a pure Western story. This is a guy who is in exile. He's not going to be able to leave this planet again without, you know, finding somebody to babysit Luke Skywalker and keep him from the, you know, hands of the Empire. He's going to have to learn how to live out here on the frontier, and also to learn to live in anonymity. For so many years, he's been at the center of the events of the galaxy. He's been, you know, this great hero of the Republic. He's been at the center of everything. And now, you know, to use the line from Star Wars, if there's a bright center to the galaxy, you're on the planet that it's farthest from. And he must learn to set aside his natural inclinations to you know, be heroic, to help people, and embrace his new role. It's particularly difficult when, you know, since this book is set, you know, immediately after the events of Episode 3, when the Republic has fallen, and you know, when you know, all the Jedi are gone, Obi-Wan definitely feels pain, anger, guilt, feelings that we deal with in this book over all the things that have happened. Also, he believes, at least at this point in time, that he killed his best friend. And
I was just going to get to that. He left him for dead.
Yeah.
You know, Anakin is burning away. And tell us about the man himself, Kenobi. You know, what is he feeling? He's now on this desert planet, exiled, if you will. And he's alone. How do you get from being this heroic person to nothing, if you will?
Well, I have to say one of the character traits about Obi-Wan is his resilience. He is a guy who is he has the, you know, the pure Jedi training. He really is the pure Jedi. He knows what it's like to he knows what it's like to be going from one strange situation to the next. He might be, you know, fighting the Hutts or something on one planet 1 minute, and then the next minute he's dealing with galactic politics or he's acting as an ambassador somewhere. He knows what the proper response is to some of these things. The problem is, where he's at right now, he has no idea whether he's going to be here for one day or 20 years or the rest of his life. And, of course, as we know, it ends up being 19 years and the rest of his life, because by the time he gets the call to go anywhere, we know what happens then.
Right.
But he's able to get to a place of peace with this. And we're right now at the very earliest stages where he's having to learn from some of the other people that he meets in the Kenobi novel how one lives on this planet. Because everybody else here is also living in isolation. They're also living on the fringe. He has to learn how to sort of turn from being Obi-Wan Kenobi, the great hero, into crazy old Ben.
As Luke Skywalker refers to him later on.
That's right.
Now you mentioned just a little bit ago that the inspiration kind of for this was Shane. You know, you shared your love of Shane. The film, and you talk about on your website, Faraway Press, this book is part Western, it's part high-stakes drama, it's part romance.
Yes.
Tell us more about that.
Well, that's one of those things. Obi-Wan is a human being. He may be a Jedi, and he may have set aside a whole lot of parts of normal life to become a Jedi, but he still is going to react to his environment. He's going to react to people that are around him. And one of the interesting things about this book, and this, I guess, takes us towards the romance, is that it is told almost exclusively, not completely, but it is told mostly from other characters' points of view. There is the wise woman who runs the local general store who realizes that Obi-Wan is very definitely more than he seems, but just doesn't have the worldliness to know really what else is going on in the galaxy. So we have her point of view. We have the point of view of a local moisture farmer who represents sort of the power and the authority that exist out here, who befriends Obi-Wan and wants to make sure that he's not going to upset any local apple carts as far as the power structure and everything. And what we have as well is a point of view character who's a Tusken Raider. And this is a, if not unprecedented thing, this is a, it's probably the deepest dive that anybody's ever done into the Tusken Raiders from the point of view of a Tusken Raider. They're what they see the world like. Mm-hmm. This is a very strange group of people. I tried to get past all the old sort of Western tropes of the settlers versus the natives to try and take it a couple of steps beyond that and really look at this particular very alien looking group. They are in many ways pathetic but not sympathetic. I wanted us to realize that their life is miserable, but not necessarily to see them as more noble as the locals, as the settlers. Both groups are doing what they feel they have to do to survive, and naturally there are clashes, and naturally Obi-Wan ends up in the middle of it.
Sounds fascinating. If you'd like to join the conversation with John Jackson Miller, you certainly can call us at 800-780-9742. Again, that phone number is 800-780-9742. You can also join us via Facebook at Route 51 Show. And we do have a caller on the line, actually, Hans. He's calling from San Jose, California. You're on Route 51. Thanks, Hans.
Morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
How are you?
Hey, Hans.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for putting out this Kenobi book at such a perfect time. Currently, I am reading the entire book line. And it just so happens that I'm on Order 66 right now, and as soon as I'm done, Kenobi will fall perfectly into the timeline, and I cannot wait for Tuesday, sir.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'll say that I made sure that this novel fits exactly into what's already out there. There's a prologue that takes place actually during Episode 3, but the rest of the book all takes place I joke about it that it all takes place during one sentence of the life and legend of Obi-Wan Kenobi. That was the biography that Scholastic put out, that writer Wyndham wrote a few years ago. It is in that time frame where he is learning to he's taken his house, new residence, and he's learning to live in this place. And you know, one of the fun things about this story is we get to see him dealing with very mundane issues. He doesn't have a door to his house yet. He doesn't have, he's got to find out how he's going to feed himself out here. And certainly he has Jedi survival techniques, but that can only take you so far when you need a pillow. That can only take you so far when you need various things for your house and, you know, water. On Tatooine, you've got to have a moisture vaporator to get water from the air, or you need to go someplace and get it yourself. And of course, as Obi-Wan finds, every time he goes someplace, trouble happens. and that's part of the fun of the book.
Awesome. I did have one question about the story. I know it takes place right after the third movie, and we do have roughly 20 years till the fourth movie. Is this going to be just one standalone book, or do you have thoughts in the back of your head to revisit a second Kenobi book maybe 5 or 10 years into the middle of the two movies?
I think there's a number of ways that you could do it. I've had several ideas. When I initially wrote the story, it was, my plan was for it to be a standalone story. And it does still stand alone. However, I, on reaching the end of it, realized that there were, 4 or 5 open questions that I could pursue. And I also realized that, there's a number of different ways to do them. And it's simply a matter of finding something that makes sense, for me and for Lucasfilm and for Random House Del Rey, the publishers of the book.
That's awesome. Hey, if you guys could keep me on hold because I'm not local, so I could listen to the rest of the conversation, I'd appreciate it.
We'll do our best, Hans. Thanks for the call.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
We have a Facebook comment, too, that is from David in San Antonio. You know, we were talked about this early just a little bit ago, that it took you a long time to write this. You know, you started about 7 years ago. Why was it so important to you, and what about this story needed to be told?
Well, as I mentioned, we originally conceived of it as a graphic novel, and as I continued to develop the idea and it got longer and longer, I realized that it was better suited for prose. It was going to be something that, it needed a treatment where we could get inside the heads of the people who are living out in these remote areas. And so I had a lot of time to think about it, and we ended up adding a number of things to the final book. One of the things was going to be, it was originally going to be a story entirely through other characters' points of view. And Jennifer Heddle, the fiction editor at Lucasfilm, suggested, well, let's add, some soliloquies, some chances for Obi-Wan to talk to the reader directly, because the other people in the book don't know what's been happening with Anakin and the Empire and everything else. And I thought that was a great idea, and when I wrote it, it worked out perfectly. And that's the thing that made this project so tantalizing to work on, is there were so many moments where I just said, okay, this is a fun, wonderful book to do, because this is going to be a situation where everybody in the story is unfamiliar with who Obi-Wan Kenobi is, but the reader has more information than anybody does. And so you're sort of right there along with him, feeling uncomfortable when his secret's about to be revealed.
We'll talk more about the book with John Jackson Miller. And the book, again, is Star Wars Kenobi. But when we come back, I'd like to talk about some other projects that you're working on, and also talk about Comic-Con, which you just came back from this past month. I'm Rick Ryer in for Glenn Moberg on Route 51. You can join the conversation at 800-780-9742. We'll be right back after this.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic, proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum, presenting Celebrating Summer, an exhibition of on-location paintings by plein air painters of America, illustrating the beauty of summer, now through August 25th. More at lywam.org.
Moss Eisley Spaceport. You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
We're back with Iola author John Jackson Miller, whose novel Star Wars Kenobi comes out next week. John, you just came back from San Diego where you attended Comic-Con 2013. What was that all about? And tell us about your experience.
Well, I went back there. I think I've gone like 13, 14 years now. It is certainly the biggest festival for comics in the United States. More than 100,000 people. There's always a huge presence there from Lucasfilm and also fandom. And what was cool this year was the folks at Del Rey, Random House, had me signing. And one of the things that they had for us, and this is probably the coolest little promotional item I've ever seen for a book, because one of the elements in the Star Wars Kenobi novel is the Krayt Dragon call. That is the call that Obi-Wan makes at the opening of A New Hope in order to scare off the Tusken Raiders from attacking him. This is actually a plot point in Star Wars Kenobi. How he learns how to use this particular ploy. And in fact, we find out that the settlers have their own Krayt Dragon calls that they use for this exact purpose. They're small little handheld keychains, just like this. And what's wonderful is that it sounds... I don't know if the listeners can hear that, but that is the original sound clip from the A New Hope movie. Leland Chi at Lucasfilm, who's sort of their archivist there, got us the original sound clip from it. It apparently was changed for the special edition or the Blu-ray. So they gave those out there, and we will also have them. I'm going to be this weekend here in Wisconsin. I'm one of the guests of honor at GeekCon, which is at the Marriott West in Madison, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And I'll have a limited supply of these there as well as stories about how this all came to be. And then I'll have them again as well. I'm doing the book release is actually on Tuesday. It is August 27th that this book releases in hardcover, ebook, audiobook as well as coming out that day. And Audible as well, and I will be doing the launch for that actually in my hometown of Memphis at the local bookseller's store that's there, and that's just a lot of fun to be able to go back to where it kind of began for me.
You also mentioned there's something coming up with Star Wars Reads.
Star Wars Reads Day. This is a big event. It was started last year by Random House and the partner publishers that they're with in the Lucasfilm licensing world. This is a literacy event. It is held first Saturday in October this year, and there are a number of participating bookstores and libraries that are going to be having Star Wars-related literacy things going on. I will be at the Madison Barnes & Noble on the west side. I know they're also having events in Minneapolis and all sorts of other different locations. I think there's a Star Wars Reads website, and it's also on Facebook that you can go to find out where your local events are. But whether or not you've got authors attending or members of the 501st, the Stormtrooper organization, or the Rebel Legion, there will be a lot of places that have giveaway items and things like that. That was another cool thing about San Diego is I was inducted a couple of years ago into the 501st, which is the organization of costuming stormtroopers as an honorary member. And at San Diego, I was inducted into the Rebel Legion, and of course, those are the good guys.
The good guys.
So I can say that if we can just get the third group, that's the Mandalorian mercs. Those are the guys that dress up like Boba Fett. I will have the trifecta.
Comic-Con 2014, perhaps. John Jackson Miller is our guest. 800-780 9742, our phone number for you to call in. And ask John a question about Star Wars Kenobi, Ben Kenobi himself, or Star Wars in general and some of the things that John is involved with in the comics industry. But I want to talk to you a little bit about a couple of years ago, you were interviewed by Marketplace magazine from Public Radio International about the comics industry and where it stood at that point. And at that point, it was not very good. Where is it today?
It's in much better shape. It's almost unrecognizable how much better shape it's in. 2 years ago, this was back before DC Comics relaunched its line with new number ones for all their titles. And at the time, we did not know whether it was a Hail Mary pass or a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea turns out to be the answer. And I think it's not simply DC. You know, Marvel has had the Avengers movies and the, you know, the success of what it's got going on in the mass media. But there's also a number of smaller publishers that are just having spectacular years. The industry is really hitting on all cylinders. And, of course, I began tracking this back in 1993 when I moved to Wisconsin to become the editor of the comics industry's trade magazine at the time, Comics Retailer. I still track this information on a website I've got called Comicron.com. I do it as a sideline, but it's something where, you know, it gives us historical perspective on how things have been going. I think this market is probably in the best shape that I've seen it in terms of you know, a sustainable situation. The comic books themselves are selling well. Digital comic sales are increasing, but they don't seem to be taking away from the sales of the original comic books, the printed comic books. And these graphic novels, these collected editions, have gotten comics into bookstores and places that they hadn't been before. So, you know, we are looking at this year in North America in the comic shop market, just the comic shop market, it's going to top $500 million.
Really?
And, you know, that is a number we have not seen since the crazy days of the early 90s when we had three or four times as many stores in what was really kind of our own real estate bubble market. You know, this is by contrast, this is much more sustainable, looks a lot healthier. You know, even, you know, every publisher on the way, all the way down the list has something. The Walking Dead is from Image. The Walking Dead alone had a market share of something like 2% last year. So, so I mean, zombies, superheroes, Star Wars, it's all helping out.
Now, a lot of this information is on your website, farawaypress.com, and we have a link to that on our Facebook page. And we'll also try to get a link to comicron.com, too, up there shortly. But there are a lot of photos of you with interesting characters from the Star Wars films and other other things, too, fun to watch. So when you go to a Comic-Con or an event like this, do you see a lot of people coming in on their own, dressed up still in the various costumes?
There are quite a lot, and, of course, some people dress as characters from the movies, but then a lot of other people specialize in characters from what they call the expanded universe, this wider group of people. You know, the biggest thrill I think I've had at a con just about was, I think it was 2007 in Los Angeles, where you know, somebody at Star Wars Celebration visited 2007 or 2008, you know, wearing the costume of one of my characters that I had created for a Star Wars series. And after that, it was another and another and another. And that was just surreal, and it is so flattering. And of course, it's also flattering to the artists who come up with these, you know, these character costume designs. You know, when we're imagining them, we have no idea how hard it is to probably put together an ensemble like that. And you know, one of my favorite things, and this story is this photo is on my Facebook page. Or Twitter, which is JJM Faraway. They actually, some fans in Memphis actually created a giant puppet of one of my characters from Knights of the Old Republic, who's sort of a grifter kind of a guy whose name is the Griff. And he's 3 feet tall and has, vaguely, simian looking features. And they actually gave me the, this giant puppet, and I remember driving back with him in the back seat of my car, and the woman at the drive-through window said I had the ugliest child she had ever seen.
Very nice. Very flattering.
So yep. Tim Brown, thank you for the griff.
Now, you mentioned the expanded universe, and that brings up a tweet that we received at Route 51 show. In regards to the Star Wars expanded universe, do you think they're cleaning the slate or doing some sort of compromise with existing stuff?
And this is a question about Star Wars Episode 7 and the new material that Disney is coming out with, which is, as far as we know, it's set in the future after Return of the Jedi. And you know, the issue involved here is that there have already been quite a lot of novels and comic books and other pieces of fiction and supporting fiction released in what we would presume to be this time frame. And so, the $64,000 question is how it's going to interact. And, the simplest answer for me is I don't know. I don't know anybody who knows. It is very early days out there with actually, producing the movies, coming up with what's going to be happening. We will all find out in time. And I'm sure that it will, it'll come out in a way that, there's a lot of people that are involved with this. And I know that the people with the fiction lines and that sort of thing, I know they have a seat at the table, and I know that they're definitely trying to I can't imagine that there isn't some sort of plan involved out there that would make everybody happy, but we're gonna have to find out. Again, people are always asking me this question, and I say, well, this is great, but I live in a small town in Wisconsin, and I'm about as far as you can get. I'm not exactly as far as Tatooine is from Coruscant, but I am a long way away from the water cooler in Los Angeles or at Lucasfilm in San Francisco.
Well, John, you've got obviously have quite a following in the Star Wars projects. Tell us about some of the other projects that you're working on, such as a new project, Overdraft, as well as something that you just kind of wrapped up, Mass Effect.
Overdraft is something that has been a long time in coming for me. I realized that over the last 10 years between comics and prose, I had written about 1 million words, and I owned maybe 5,000 of them. It's something that every author wants to be able to balance having their work in these other sandboxes and also their own. And so Overdraft is that. It is a project that I did with 47 North, which is Amazon's science fiction line. It is set in our universe in the 22nd century, and it is sort of aliens and armored mercenaries take on Wall Street. We have a stockbroker, a conniving stockbroker, who manages to bankrupt his entire interstellar expedition. And the mercenaries with the expedition, rather than deciding to go into unemployment, return to the solar system to grab him and drag him forcibly back to the edge of the galaxy to try to get their money back one planet at a time. And so what we have here is this reluctant interstellar traitor who's out there, who's being defended by people who really don't like him. And it was released as a Kindle serial initially, where it was we would give people a 12,000 word chunk of the story every 2 weeks, and it is now finally available on Amazon, and it's going to be available in other bookstores as well in its completed edition. But it is a lot of fun to be able to set my own rules for a universe. And there's some nice things about this world that that have story opportunities. There's no instantaneous communication between stars, as you might see in Star Wars or Star Trek or something like that. So that makes things very much like the Age of Sail, where you had no idea when expeditions would actually get where they were going. Another thing is I actually put in a size limit to interstellar transport, so nothing larger than about a railroad car can go from one planet to another, or from one star to another, which means it's much more like the container traffic that we have here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And if you want to send a gigantic starship, you have to break it down like Legos and then put it back together on the other end. I think that it's just a lot of fun playing with the conventions with that. And Overdraft, by contrast, say, to Mass Effect, which is also, it's a video game license that I wrote the comics for, or some of the comics for. By contrast to that, Mass Effect is very dark, very serious. Overdraft has a number of serious concepts in it, and it has life and death moments in it. But it also is a lot lighter in a lot of ways. There's a lot of humor in there, and that's kind of the requirement for me to get interested in a project. There have to be some funny moments. There's also funny moments in Kenobi as well.
There's a lot going on in that brain of yours, John. Now, I have a big question for you right now.
Okay.
And I alluded to this at the open of the show. You're now voyaging over to the Star Trek universe. Are you firing on all thrusters, John?
Warp factor confused. No. I'm. This is something that I had the opportunity to do. Pocket Books, which has the Star Trek license, does a number of novellas, which are just electronic books that are short of the length of a full novel. And I've done a lot of shorter fiction, e-books, that sort of thing. Already, I've got Lost Tribe of the Sith for Star Wars that we did, right. I have another Overdraft short story that's out there as well, called Human Error, which is a lot of fun. The Star Trek, this is something which I've been interested in almost as long as Star Wars. I don't think I really got into it until the 80s, starting with the TV shows and the movies, and then Star Trek: The Next Generation, and then watching the later series. It used to be that there was this schism between the Star Trek and Star Wars
fandoms.
I was
going to ask you about that, right?
I don't think that really applies anymore, because there's certainly a lot of other people to be upset with. Twilight, other fans. We've got other fans to be upset with. I think the thing is, they both of these storylines have attracted different kind of storytelling. There are concepts that I would never put in to a Star Wars story, because I can look at it and say, ha, quantum mechanics. This is just on the face of it, I know that this is a Star Trek thing. You can't mention that in Star Wars, right. Or at least you shouldn't, because it's supposed to be a space fantasy, and we don't really get into sort of the details. Star Trek, this is something where actually having there are characters whose whole role is to be your sort of guru or guide into the fake metaphysics of fake physics of the Star Trek universe. This particular story is called Absent Enemies, and it is part of what's known as the Star Trek Titan line. Titan is the starship that William Riker, the first officer from Star Trek: The Next Generation, takes over as captain after the end of Star Trek Nemesis, and he is the captain of this ship. This ship also has Deanna Troi, who is now his wife, also it has as sort of his sounding board sidekick, first officer in this storyline, a character named Tuvok, who people may recognize from Star Trek Voyager. He was the Vulcan character who really, in my story, serves as, we almost have a Kirk-Spock dynamic between Riker and Tuvok, and that's mm-hmm. that was just a lot of fun to write. We do not have a release date on that, but it is done from my end, so it probably won't be too awful long.
that's Star Trek, as well as Star Wars, they both have this amazing staying power. It's incredible.
I think so.
Generation to generation.
I think so, and that's because they can. The galaxies are big enough. The MOUs are big enough that they can reinvent themselves. They can add different kinds of stories. The story that's in Lost Tribe of the Sith again is a story with no technology whatsoever, because it's a bunch of Sith underlings who get trapped on a planet for 5,000 years, having to rely only on their wits and their lightsabers and their dark side magic. That's a different kind of story completely from you know, a story where you've got, you know, giant spaceships blasting at each other, going after the planet-destroying menace of the week. And again, Star Wars Kenobi is yet another take on it because it's got this Western feel to it. It's a much more personal feel, a much smaller story. I think all of these different universes that have been created, can be the groundwork for being reinterpreted a number of different ways.
John Jackson Miller, our guest today on Route 51. You can join us today by calling 800-780-9742. Again, that's 800-780-9742. Or you can join us on Facebook at Route 51 Show. We'll be back right after this.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Stevens Point Area Co-op, Peninsula Music Festival, and Import Auto Clinic. You, too, can help ensure the future of WPR with your business sponsorship. Find out more at wpr.org/sponsor.
Support also comes from the Old Rittenhouse Inn in Bayfield, offering lodging options with guest rooms and suites available in three historic homes near downtown. Virtual tours, wine list, and more information at rittenhouseinn.com.
Let me see your identification.
You don't need to see his identification.
We don't need to see his identification.
These aren't the droids you're looking for.
These aren't the droids we're looking for.
He can go about his business.
Go about your business.
Move along.
Move along. Move along.
I gotta tell you, that's one of my favorite scenes in all of the Star Trek, Star Wars, there I go, Star Wars films. My wife and I always just kind of mouth that every single time that we watch it. It's hilarious. Rick Ryer in for Glenn Moberg this week on Route 51. We're talking with John Jackson Miller, whose latest book, Star Wars Kenobi, comes out next week. We're all excited about that, and I've been looking forward to it myself for quite some time. And John, how would Ben Kenobi live and survive in this world?
Oh wow, I don't even know where to go with that. They have very explicitly made it the case that Earth is not anywhere in the Star Wars universe. In fact, when we're writing the stories, there are a number of Earth-related terms that we just don't use. Earthquake, for example, is groundquake. There are a number of things where you just wouldn't want to put that word in a character's mouth because it would not sound normal at all. I think that's again one of those differences between the worlds. In Star Trek, you can bring Kirk and Spock and everybody back to San Francisco to go riding on the local bus. I'm not sure I would want to see that happening with Star Wars, but I think the place where George Lucas and Lucasfilm got to play with that was Indiana Jones, and that was one of the cool experiences I had a few years ago. Was I got to write the graphic novel adaptation for the Indiana Jones movie that came out a few years ago, The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and that's a place where knowing history and things about Earth come in handy, and I enjoyed that quite a bit. So I can tell that Mr. Lucas must have had fun switching between those worlds and being able to flex different parts of the creative muscles there and history background.
Well, tell us more about the transition between from Obi-Wan Kenobi to crazy old Ben.
Well, he is naturally driven to help people. He is naturally driven to his role, his official role as a Jedi Knight has been to keep peace and order in the galaxy, and to sort of be the freelance policeman, if you will, for the Republic. I often think that the Republic got a mostly pretty good deal having these Jedi there just show up and decide they're going to take on all these responsibilities for them freelance. Of course, one of the things that I've also explored in some of my other stories is that it's not always been a great deal for them, because of course every so often one of these Jedi will go nuts and put on a black helmet and create chaos. I think it is absolutely in Obi-Wan Kenobi's programming to help people wherever he can. And right from the first minute that he's going on the run, he's got to either start restraining his impulses, I've joked about this, that this is the novel in which he can't react to anything as Superman. He must be Clark Kent. And, you know, with those kinds of stories, you still see the hero acting, and he's still able to act, you know, in super ways, but he just can't do it in such a way that you can see, you know, oh, well, that's obviously, he's obviously a Jedi Knight, because if this is found out, you know, he's jeopardized, and Luke Skywalker is jeopardized. And, you know, that the other part about this is he really just has to surrender to the role that he's going to have. Luke Skywalker is the new hope. Obi-Wan Kenobi is coming to grips with the fact that he is part of the hope that failed, and he is part of the past for the Republic and the galaxy. The future is in the next generation. It's very difficult for anybody, and people deal with this in real life, where they realize that, okay, you know, that's it for me. It's the next generation that's going to solve things, and yeah, he's reluctant to give up his role.
I just lost my next question. Sorry about that, John.
Well, that's a Jedi mind trick,
yeah,
on my part.
There you go. It works on me sometimes. Anyway, we won't go there anymore. 1-800-780-9742, number to call if you have a question for John about Star Wars, Kenobi, or the upcoming film, perhaps. We talked a little bit about that just a little while ago. Episode 7, what can you tell us about what you know or not know about what to expect in 2015?
I know is, again, absolutely nothing. You know, the stuff that everybody is putting on the internet, who knows what if that is true? I mean, I think the latest rumors this week were about the release date. When would it be released in 2015? Would it be May? Would it be Christmas? You've got people that are studying, Disney's release schedule. Fans that are studying Disney's release schedule. Well, when is the Avengers coming out? What weekend can this thing possibly come out? Hey, didn't those Lord of the Rings movies come out in December? You know, they're doing all these. It's almost like the Kremlinology that people used to do in the United States, studying the Russians from the outside to see if they could get any hint at who is really in power or what's really going on. And, you know, the fans are interested in this. It's wonderful that they're interested. I remember, you know, being in the same position as a kid, 9 years old, 10 years old. When Alan Dean Foster's Splinter of the Mind's Eye novel came out, that was the first expanded universe novel, and it was a Luke and Leia and Darth Vader adventure that was put out by Del Rey at the time. And I remember reading that and saying, wow, this is the next Star Wars movie. It's got to be the next Star Wars movie. How can it not be the next Star Wars movie? And it turned out not to be the next Star Wars movie. but that's the thing. I mean, we're all, this is something that's going to be happening at the movie production level. And, we will all find out more information. The people that are working in this world, these licensees and people that work for the licensees, we'll all find out. And, I think it'll be just like when we did the prequel movies. They got everybody on board and they coordinated everything. And, I expect good things.
And most likely a guaranteed blockbuster highest grossing film in the history of film?
I have no idea. I would certainly expect so, because, how many years now are people going to have been asking about it? So
we have a Facebook question from Brian in North Carolina regarding a potential appearance by somebody we may know as a Force ghost in Kenobi. What's that all about?
He's asking about Qui-Gon Jinn, and that was Liam Neeson's character in Star Wars Episode 1. We do not see it on camera in Star Wars Episode 3, but it does happen in the novelization that there's an appearance by Qui-Gon Jinn, Obi-Wan's master, as a Force ghost. And he basically says, well, once you go to Tatooine, my former Padawan, I'll be able to talk with you and you won't be alone. We'll be communing through the Force. The issue, however, is when my novel is set, Qui-Gon is not yet answering. He's not answering the phone. And it's a source of frustration for Obi-Wan. And this is why his meditations that are in the book often tend to be soliloquies, because he has not yet reached that level of peace or that point in the continuity where I know they actually are talking together to get an answer back. This does not stop Obi-Wan from trying. It's a very good question, and I would suggest reading the book.
And that we will. Thank you so much, John, for joining us today. John Jackson Miller, latest book, a novel in the Star Wars universe, Star Wars Kenobi. It's jam-packed. I can't wait to read this. Thank you so much, and we hope to have you back again next August, perhaps.
So we'll see, Rick.
Okay. I'm Rick Ryer in for Glenn Moberg today, joining talking with John Jackson Miller. Thank you so much to Jane Ritger for her on-air production today. Next week, we'll be talking about what's happening in Congress, as Glenn Moberg will be coming back and welcoming Congressman Sean Duffy. Till then, may the force be with you. We're heading out of town.